listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Jessie Norman is not only one of the greatest opera singers of all time, her brilliant light shines in many directions. She is one of this nation's, in fact, this world's cultural treasures. And from her new memoir, we learn that she's a great storyteller, too. Tonight, you will have the rare opportunity to hear Miss Norman talk about her extraordinary life's journey, from her childhood growing up in the Jim Crow South, a descendant of many generations of hardworking slave and free ancestors, where she sang in the local church and attended a segregated school, to her much-lauded career in opera, to her forays into spirituals, blues, and jazz, and her lifetime commitment to arts education. The title of her new book comes from an admonition which Miss Norman's mother, Janie King Norman, a force herself, repeated often to her daughter, "Stand up straight and sing." And as you'll see, this book is as much about standing up as it is about singing, standing up for yourself in the face of injustice. And when you read it, I'm confident that you'll find, as I did, that Jessie Norman's voice, legendary from recordings and concerts, is vibrantly alive on the pages of this beautiful memoir. I will not attempt to recount all of Jessie Norman's countless awards. She is one of America's, as you know, most accomplished singers, with 5 Grammys, dozens of international prizes, and a Kennedy Center honor among them. She's sung on stages all over the world, from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera to the Place de la Concorde in Paris for the bicentennial of the French Republic. She's sung for 4 U.S. presidents, for Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama, and for Rosa Parks and Marian Anderson, too. Here is a life that deserves to be told, and I'm thrilled that we'll all be able to hear her speak about it in person tonight. And also very delighted that in conversation with Miss Norman tonight, we are able to welcome back Deborah Borda, President and CEO of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, our neighbor up Grand Avenue. The Phil, which you know, which has thrived under Deborah's leadership, building new bridges to the community in Los Angeles and far beyond. It is indeed a great honor. Please join me in welcoming Jessie Norman and Deborah Borda to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good evening, Miss Norman.
Good evening.
Good evening, everybody. I'm glad you braved the heat. You know, as I was preparing to do this, maybe your mother said, stand up straight and sing. I was thinking, sit up straight and do this interview. You know, it really is such a distinct honor to be interviewing somebody who is not only an incomparable artist, but as Louise said, really, I consider a national treasure.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you.
And as I read the book, I found myself, I was reading it really very much at the beginning for the musical part of it, being a musicoid. But I found myself so deeply moved by the social narrative and the cultural context. And in the end, I saw that it wasn't just a book about, not that it would just be a book because it's written by Jessie Norman, but it wasn't about the life of a superstar opera singer. It was really the story of struggles of coming of age and of the formation of the identity of a powerful American woman. And I found that so moving.
Thank you.
Now, your book opens. I don't know, have people yet had a chance to read the book?
No.
We're going to, all right. Okay. Well, then we're going to tell them a lot tonight.
Absolutely.
The book opens against a backdrop of the assassination of Martin Luther King. The country you had left behind was on fire, literally.
Yes. I went to Europe for the very first time
In 1968, I was still a student at the University of Michigan, where I was working on a master's degree in performance. And I had the opportunity to go to Europe to participate in international competitions, if you can imagine, at the arrangement of the United States Information Agency. Can you imagine there was a time in Washington, D.C., when there was an agency interested in education? Amazing. Well, it happened that they were not only interested in those of us that were pursuing music degrees or studying music, but also students from various other disciplines within a university setting. And the aim was to know how our education in the United States measured up against the education of children, of students that were of a similar age and studying similar disciplines. And so I was very happy to be chosen and to be among the students that were being sent to participate in competitions. And the first competition in which I was to participate was in Munich, the international music competition it is called, and it was not only for singing. It was for piano, for woodwinds, for brass, and I think string quartet. And so there were a lot of disciplines within the music that were involved. And it was a wonderful time to meet students from all over the world. There were 85 singers, so this is quite a competition. And it was a marvelous time to understand how students my own age were viewing our country at the time. Everybody knew that Dr. Martin Luther King had been assassinated earlier in the year. They also knew that Newark, Detroit, Philadelphia, Washington were all ablaze. And that, as I write in the book, the students at Berkeley hadn't been to classes in months. And so sitting in at administration buildings and wanting things to change in a hurry was something that was certainly very present in our lives at that time. And leaving the country to go to this competition at that moment was an incredible experience, because not only were we aware of what was going on socially and politically in this country, we were curious about what was going on in other places. I mean, if anybody can remember, in 1968, there was a huge outcry from students in Paris. So there were marches and all kinds of student demonstrations, you might recall. And it had to do more with their being forced to pay to go to university, which was new. And of course, we very do not have free university education in this country yet, but we can live in hope. So it was a marvelous time. It was a wonderful experience. I traveled with a friend of mine from Howard University. We had been very good friends there. He had been the pianist, actually, in the studio of my professor of voice there. And we had worked on the music all summer long to go to Munich. And that's how the book opens.
I always think that the opening of a book is sort of like an overture. So it presages what is to come, what is to follow in the rest of the book.
And yes.
If the United States was on fire and Brynhilde was once surrounded by a ring of fire, I felt you were under fire from the judges at that competition. And it was fascinating to me because it seemed it was both a personal and a musical awakening for you to overcome what they threw at you.
Yes, well, we have to explain what happened. It was a competition in Munich, and there were three rounds to the competition. In the first round, one had to have sent ahead of time, many months ahead of time, the list of music that you intended to perform in whatever discipline you were performing. And so that had to have been agreed by the people that were in charge of the competition. And so I was entering the competition as an opera and as a concert singer. So there was a lot of repertoire involved. And the periods of the repertoire were decided by the committee there for the competition. So we had to have things from the Baroque era, from the classical era, from the Romantic era, and then things that were considered contemporary composers. And so this had already been sent ahead of time to them. Everything was approved. And so for the first round, you were able to choose yourself what you would perform, as long as it was within the, I think, a 15 or 16 minute time limit. And so I performed a work of Bach, something of Mozart, something of Handel, and the last thing that I performed was the second aria from Elisabeth's in Tannhäuser of Wagner. And so it was very unusual, after the first round, that I was invited by the adjudicators to a meeting with them. Now, normally, as a lot of you will certainly know, in a competition, there is absolutely no interaction between the judges and the competitors. But they were doing a special favor for me and invited me to have a talk with them, wherein they said that they felt that I was having an unfair advantage over the other 84 participants because I had arrived with my own pianist. Now, do understand that there were singers that were working with their coaches playing for them. Some of them were working with their voice professors playing for them, and several of them were working with their spouses playing for them. But somehow my having my own accompanist was giving me an unfair advantage. So the first thing that happened was that the judges decided that I would have to work with a pianist that was coming from their organization, that I would have to lose my own pianist. And at the time, all 22 years of me said to the person that became my accompanist, okay, this is the way it is, but we have a lot of rehearsing to do. Because I have a lot of songs and some arias that we will have to work on together, because I would prefer that we would do these in the way that I have prepared them and not in the way perhaps that you're used to playing them. And so we managed to rehearse properly, and miracle of miracles, I made it through the second round as well. And the adjudicators were not done with me. They needed to have another meeting with me. Such special treatment. And this time, they stated that as I had sung in the first round, the second aria of Elisabeth, which is a prayer, and those of you who might know the opera, those of us who sing this know very well that the second aria, which comes in the third act, is really much more difficult than the one that opens the second act when the character actually enters the opera, Dichtere Halle, the big aria that everybody knows. And really, truly, if you have a conductor and an orchestra behind you, this aria sings itself. It truly does. But my professor had said to me that it was not a good idea to sing the first aria because it doesn't work well with piano, whereas one can manage the second aria with piano. And so the judges said to me at this time that as I had sung the second aria in the first round, that they would dearly love to have me sing the first aria with piano. And so I said that this would be against their own rules, which I knew by heart. And so I allowed myself to say, now I'm looking into, remember this, I'm still a university student. I'm looking into the faces of very famous singers, of people that are critics, very famous sort of piano coaches and all the rest of it. And I managed to say that the rules stipulated that I could not be asked to sing anything that was not on my list and which had not been approved. So therefore, I would, as I said, prefer not to sing the first aria with piano. And after a bit of jousting and a bit of trying to convince me to do otherwise, they did realize that I would not be moved and that we would stick to the rules. And it had already been announced, those of us who had passed the second round, as to the 12 of us, now it had, was whittled down to 12 performers, that I was to be in the third round. And I think, quite honestly, it would have been slightly embarrassing if it had turned out that I was not allowed to sing in the third round because of the way they were, as it were, giving me those very special meetings.
Now, we want you all to read the book, but I will tell you, as I said, the overture presages what is to come. Ms. Norman triumphs. Now, you've worked with really some of the greatest conductors
yes.
that have existed in our time, certainly von Karajan, Jimmy Levine,
yes.
Zawa. But let's be honest, there must have been a time earlier in your career when you worked with conductors who were perhaps less than brilliant lights. And I wondered in never,
no,
well, let me ask you this.
No,
really?
No, it's extremely important to understand that I had the amazing advantage of working with conductors whose names you might not know, but who were fantastic at their jobs, because they, all over Germany, and this is still true, there must be, I cannot count them, but certainly thinking of them very quickly, there must be at least 8 different orchestras that are attached to radio networks within that particular area of Germany, whether you're talking about the Frankfurt or Munich or Hamburg or Berlin. All of these places have their own orchestras, and so they have their own conductors. And so I was able to work with Rudolf Kempe. It might not be a name that you know, but this was a tremendous conductor. And a name that you probably certainly do not know, a man by the name of Hans Müller-Kreil. This was an extraordinary man. Not only did we sit together and talk about the music and talk about the phrasing, but because I really felt myself to be a student, that I was listening and hanging on every word that these conductors had to say. And I feel very grateful for the opportunity that I had to work with these people that were, as we would call them, work-a-day conductors, but that were really rather fantastic at what they were doing, because they had the experience, they had the know-how, and they also had the patience, which was extremely important. The person that was conducting the third round of the competition in Munich was a man by the name of Kurt Eichhorn. Kurt Eichhorn had been conducting for 50 years by the time I got to him. He knew practically everything there was to know about this, and to make it clear, and to give the orchestra 2 and to give me 4. None of this was complicated for him. And it was marvelous to be able to have the privilege of working with people that were so far much more experienced than I, and from whom I could learn. So I didn't have the experience of working with conductors that were trying to find their way as I was trying to find my way. I was able to learn and to be educated by people that had been doing their work for decades.
Were you ever interested in being a conductor yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I've always been interested in conducting. And I have to tell a story on myself. I'm not really a morning person. And the only reason I took choral conducting at university, but the only reason I did not take orchestral conducting was that the class, I'm afraid, met at 7:40 in the morning. And because I am as I am, I did go to the department and I said, you know, I really want to take orchestral conducting. Is there any way we could change the time of day? Why not? You know, you don't get if you don't ask.
Well, you know, it's perfectly fair. Concerts happen in the evening for the most part.
But this was at Howard University, and we had the advantage of having the conductors that would come to work with the National Symphony. They were so fabulous in coming to work with the students at least once during the course of their time with the symphony. The conductor, whoever it was, and, you know, sometimes it was people whose names, you know, were in bold print in the newspapers and so on, and they would come and teach that class. But, of course, they needed to do that before going to a 10 o'clock rehearsal with the orchestra, with the National Symphony. So therefore, the classes had to be at an hour that would accommodate this. And that's the only reason that I didn't take orchestral conducting.
I bet you would have been great at it.
Well, there are conductors who kind of think that I conduct anyhow.
No, I've heard of that. Let me ask you, why aren't there more women conductors?
They're not more women conductors for the same reason they're not more women CEOs, not more women presidents, not more women heads of state, because we need to have the world to understand that half the population is just as capable as the other half of the population. And I remember reading that the formula for success is opportunity and preparation coming together. And we have lots of women in this country and in other places that are fantastic musicians, that are able, that are prepared to conduct orchestras. They simply need the opportunity to conduct an orchestra.
I was struck throughout the book, really, well, from the beginning of the book, by the very strong feminist position you occupied, starting as a child and carried through life. What was responsible for that?
I think that growing up in the household with my parents telling us practically on a daily basis, here we are in the segregated South, and my parents said as often as they could that we were as good and as loved by the Creator as anyone else on earth, and that it would often be the case that we would have to work harder in order to show and to prove that we were as good, but that was just the way the world was at that time. And I am still the 12-year-old in middle school who wanted to take shop instead of home ec. And I was foolish enough to say to my home ec teacher, thinking it wasn't really seriously, I wasn't rebellious at all. I just thought they didn't know that I would prefer to take shop. And so I went along to Miss Reynolds and I said, Miss Reynolds, you know, I really don't think I want to learn how to sew and to cook, and that I will pick that up as I go along and so on, because my mother and my grandmother and my aunts and my girl cousins that are older than I, they're all very good cooks, and they can also, and I'm sure I'll pick that up at some point. But what I would like to learn to do is to make a table. That I would really love to do. And I was told at the time that girls don't take shop. And I thought, truly, I thought that they felt that I would be uncomfortable in a room with boys. And I said, don't worry about that. I've got three brothers. I can't tell you how many cousins. And there are all these boys that live on the street. And we play softball together. I'll be absolutely fine. And Ms. Reynolds didn't think that that was a good enough reason for me to take shop. And I didn't think that was a good enough reason for me to have to take home economics. And it turned out that my parents were invited to the school. My father was president of the PTA, so he and the principal were very good friends. So it wasn't as tension-filled as it might have been otherwise. But it was made very clear to me that girls do not take shop. They take home ec. And boys take shop, and that was all right. And so my little protest was to take something to read to home economics, which did not endear me to Miss Reynolds, I have to say. But she did give me extra essays to write so that I would not have my grade average brought down by the fact that I was not participating in learning to cook. But I think the thing that really sort of the straw that broke the camel's back of this 12-year-old was when Miss Reynolds said not only were we going to learn to cook, but we were going to prepare breakfast and we were going to invite the boys in our class to come to breakfast.
Can we have a round of hissing, please?
That went a bit too far. And so I, still not wanting my grade average to go down because I was being silly about home economics, so I chose to decorate the tables with the flowers. I always loved flowers, so I could do that, and therefore I was participating in making breakfast for the boys. And so I got away with it.
Well, now I have a very important question to ask you. To a woman who can sing the role of Cassandra in Didon in the same night, that is a marathon, can you make a table?
I can now.
Very good.
Yes.
How do you select the roles that you want to perform?
I tend to gravitate to characters in operas that are perhaps a bit more complex than some other characters. I enjoy going through the inner workings of that character's mind and trying to, as best I can, to portray the different layers of thinking. There's a lot going on in the mind of a Kundry. And Sieglinde is living under circumstances that would make any woman unhappy. And a person walks into the house with whom she falls in love immediately. And these characters simply are more interesting for me. The character of Alceste or Dido. Dido, a character who has brought Carthage back to its former economic growth and reign in the world, and allows herself for the second time in her life to fall in love. And then what does Aeneas want to do? He wants to go off for the greater things. One of the greater things that he wants to do happens to be to find and to found Rome. So that can't be said to have been a very small thing. But at the same time, it shows that even though Dido was a queen of Carthage, she was vulnerable to falling in love. And to have this second person in her life to leave her is quite a moment. And it is quite a wonderful thing to sing, whether one is doing the Berlioz, the Trojans, or Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. The lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, I think, is one of the most beautiful things that one can sing in G minor. I really do.
And from the other side of it, from Troyen, I think that the beginning of the second part of Troyen, when Dido, or Didon, as we call her in the opera, makes her entrance, it is the definition of leadership.
Absolutely.
And it is a woman leader.
Absolutely.
Who has led her country.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody sings glory to Dido, and it is the most wonderful entry. I mean, you don't have to sing. You just stand and everybody else is singing. and you just have to sort of look rather wonderful. I mean, you have a beautiful costume and somebody's done your hair and everything is fabulous. I don't sing a lot of roles where I get to dress up and, you know, most of the time it's sackcloth and ashes. But I enjoy those roles too.
You describe in the book opera as a marathon. And of course, if you're singing both Cassandra and Didon, that really is a marathon. But for most hours, operas will only say 3 hours or 4 hours in length. When you learn a new role, how do you prepare?
I prepare a new role in the same way that I prepare a song that lasts for 5 or 6 minutes, or sometimes even less, by looking at the text and looking at the music and see how they go together. This is one of the reasons that I have difficulty singing roles in translation. At the Met, we have had the occasion to do some of the operas of Janáček, which are in Czech, of course, and Bartók, which is in Hungarian. And for fear that we would have no one in the audience, we first performed these operas in English. And it is very difficult to take a musical phrase that is written in one language and have it really work in English, where we need more words to say the same sort of thing. So I have found that to be a bit of a challenge. But in choosing and working on a role, it is always the marriage of the music and the words together. And I enjoy the work. I try to encourage my younger colleagues to find joy in the preparation. Because if we're comfortable and joyful on stage, that translates to the audience as well. And if we are really committed to expressing a text, then it really doesn't matter if the audience doesn't speak French or doesn't speak Italian or doesn't speak German or doesn't speak Hungarian. If we're actually giving the words their due, you should be able to understand what is happening in the opera at that moment without having to read the message that is on the back of the seat in front of you or to read the message that is overhead in the super titles. But I really feel that the marriage of words and music this is such a gift. And as I write in the book, we singers, as musicians, have another level of responsibility. We have words, and they have to be understood, and we have to understand them. And it is not enough to work with a coach who's going to sort of tell you how something is pronounced, and then you can look up to see how what something means. I don't sing in a language that I don't speak. The language in which I read, I don't pretend to speak Hungarian, I read Hungarian, so I must clarify that. And there is one exception. I sing in Hebrew. I have a fantastic rabbi. And every time I'm getting ready to sing in Hebrew, I go to Rabbi Friedlander, and we sit together for hours. I know what every word means. I know how to pronounce it. He listens to me. I record it. I go back. Have I gotten anything wrong? Because I understand that this is a language of a people. This has to be done correctly. And even though this is not something that is in my brain as a language, I feel that I need to work on it so that a person hearing the language will say, yes, I understand what she's saying. I understand that she understands what this all means.
Last week, I was having dinner with our music director, Gustavo Dudamel, and pretty well-known guy who designed Walt Disney Concert Hall and a few other buildings, Frank Gehry. So I was bragging.
Other.
I was bragging. I said, they said, well, will you be at the opening concert on Thursday night? And I said, oh, no, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I'm interviewing Jesse Norman. And so Gustavo goes, oh, amazing, amazing.
Amazing, really amazing.
I wish I could be there, but I have a concert. And with Joshua Bell, as almost as we speak. And then Frank said, yeah, I want to be there. He said, but, you know, I have to be in Abu Dhabi. Someplace more exotic. You know.
Exactly. Well, so a one-upmanship.
This turned into a conversation, actually, about you, and very quickly gravitated to something we all shared in common, in addition to our admiration. And that was that our Desert Island recording is your recording of the Strauss Four Last Songs.
Thank you.
Kurt Mazur and the Leipzig Gewandhaus. We talked about that. Singers never like hearing this, but we compared it to other recordings. You were the winner.
Well, thank you. So that's very kind.
That's good. And that's the truth, too.
Thank you.
So I thought it would be wonderful. We actually both thought it would be wonderful right now just to take a little break from the dialogue and to listen to this particular recording to the third of the songs. I'm Schlafengehen, and I was very nervous about pronouncing German in front of you.
No, that's very good, very good.
And so if we could just take a few minutes and listen to this. It's based on it is the poetry of Hermann Hesse.
Hermann Hesse, on going to sleep, eternal sleep.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You write in your book that you can't imagine life without the four last songs.
I cannot imagine life without the four last songs. And I can't imagine life without this particular experience that I had with the Leipzig Gewandhaus. Imagine the person who played the violin solo had been playing in the orchestra for 45 years. And these sessions were his last performances with the Gewandhaus Orchestra. And he was so interested in our being of one mind in this song that he gave me the honor of coming to my dressing room. And we were recording in the Lukaskirche in a church, so the dressing room was probably the vestry of some priest or the other. And he came to me because he wanted to imagine. He wanted to play his solo, and he wanted me to listen to it and to suggest whether it was too fast or too slow or whatever. And I had been on earth a shorter period of time than that man had been playing in the orchestra. And he did me the honor of wanting to play his solo for me. And it was certainly something that I shall never forget. And I shall always be grateful for the kindness of a person who had that amount of experience, but still wanted to make music. He wanted a collaboration. And that was very meaningful and remains a marvelous, marvelous memory for me. Thank you.
His name was Gerhard Boss, and yes. His father had actually been the concertmaster of the Gewandhaus under Robert Schumann.
Yes, under Robert Schumann, the Robert Schumann.
Yeah, yeah, not Bob Schumann. I'm on my third CD of that particular. And you know, you should get it because the rest of the Strauss songs in it are fabulous as well. Okay, let's go a little bit lighter because this story made me laugh.
Tell me.
And I had actually seen it on television. You had been asked, or you were asked and performed at the bicentennial of the French Revolution.
Yes.
In Paris. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching it, and you wore the most amazing red, white, and blue gown.
Yes.
And you performed a truly memorable and daring feat under the Arc de Triomphe, as I recall.
The Place de la Concorde.
That's where it was.
Oui.
And then, so if you could tell that story, but then please don't leave out how you made your way back to the hotel and how you made your way through the crowd using your brother.
Well, this was actually, this was the Bastille Day, of course, is always the 14th of July. So we were actually coming back from a rehearsal on the 13th of July. And of course, we were dressed in summer clothing and just there for the rehearsal. And we had a call from the office of the president of France, François Mitterrand, that he wanted those of us that were involved in that particular part of the parade, as it were, for the next day. He wanted us to join the heads of state, all 55 of them, at dinner at the Musée d'Orsay, which is a museum in Paris where they were having dinner. And we hesitated because none of us were dressed to go to dinner. I mean, not dinner with one another, much less dinner with sort of 55 heads of state. And so, but we were told that we were invited and that our presence was wanted. And so off we went. And so we were there for this marvelous dinner in this beautiful place, sort of dressed like strangers. I'm sure we stood out like sore thumbs. But we had a wonderful time. And there had been earlier in the week some confusion about which heads of state from former French colonies were who, and some of the names were confused. So when my brother, who was called George, walked into the room, they didn't know who he was. And so there was some consternation as to who is this head of state and does anybody know who he is? And I quickly sort of put out that fire by saying, oh, please don't worry, that's my brother George. And he was seated next to the brother of the president of France, and he loved to tell the story that the brother of the president of France said to him, "I know what it's like being somebody's brother." But after that wonderful experience, and we were just delighted, of course, to be included in such a dinner, it was time to, the next day was the thing, and I needed to get some rest, and it was now quite late at night, but there were hundreds and thousands of people in the streets of Paris. I mean, people had come from all over the world to witness this, and they had parked themselves in front of various hotels, knowing that various heads of state were staying in those hotels. And so it was very difficult to kind of get through the street, even though we had people that were helping us to do this. And when we arrived at the hotel where we were staying, it was truly impossible to get anywhere near the door. And all of the security people and policemen and so on in Paris at the time had been given instruction not to disturb the crowds, to allow them to do what they wanted and not to sort of make any problems for people sort of gathering in the streets and perhaps staying up all night and all the rest of it, to allow people to enjoy this moment. And so the security people were very cautious about asking people to get out of the way so that we could actually get to the door of the hotel. And I was beginning to feel just a tiny bit desperate as we'd been standing there for about 20 minutes, and there was no hope of getting through this crowd of people, hundreds of people, that was standing in front of this hotel. And so I thought, aha, I will do something. I will get through this crowd. And so with my brother having already been mistaken earlier in the evening for someone that he was not, I said to him, "Par ici, Monsieur le Président." And I promise you, I said in English, "Please come this way, Mr. President. I promise you the water's parted." The Red Sea had nothing on this. The waters parted. Everybody was applauding. No, seriously. And because my brother was the way he was, he walked in front of me. Yes, he did.
I guess.
I sort of walked behind him, you know, sort of grateful to get into the hotel.
You didn't have your Azadine Alaya gown on at that point.
I don't know. I had a summer dress and sandals.
I hear you give wonderful dinner parties.
Yes, I love to give dinner parties.
If you could invite any composer, living or dead, to your dinner party, who would you invite?
Schubert.
If you could add a conductor, we don't want conductors. If you could add an author, who would you add?
Whom?
An author.
An author.
We have Schubert.
Uh-huh. I would probably invite Hermann Hesse. I would love to talk to him about his poetry. I'd love to talk to him about his theory of meditation and what he didn't refer to it at that time, but this Zen-like approach to being in the world and being of the world and in it. I would love to have been able to speak with him and to understand his incredible gift for writing poems that, of course, were very popular for those of us that were coming of age in the late 60s. I mean, we were reading Hesse in translation and thinking that we were quite wonderful, you know.
What's the difference between spirituals and gospel?
Yes. Well, that's very easy, and I'm very happy that you asked that question, because I would like to have this clarified throughout the world so that we understand.
This will be on the podcast.
This will be on the podcast. The spirituals can only, American spirituals can only have been composed between about 1610 and about 1866, the period of slavery in this country. Spirituals were composed, they were not composed, spirituals were created by people in bondage who had the faith to be able to see beyond their bondage. There's nothing in the spiritual that is about revenge or when this is over, this is what I'm going to do. It's all about getting to heaven, to a better place where there's plenty good room, where there's a balm in Gilead. Roll, Jordan, roll. I'll get across Jordan and it'll be a better place. You need to understand also that the Bible was the only book that was allowed, and that the teachings from the Bible were offered in a very rudimentary fashion, because the people that were instructing and overseeing the slaves were not educated people. So you have a situation where people are deciding how they're going to get through a situation, not out of a situation, but through a situation. Know also that communication was done also through these songs. The drums had already been taken away because it had been understood by the overseers that it's possible to send messages with these drums. So they were taken away. But the human spirit doesn't die that quickly. It doesn't wilt, not that quickly. And so we hear a spiritual like, I couldn't hear nobody pray, and it's a beautiful spiritual, but there was a message in that spiritual. That spiritual, sung from plantation to plantation, was to alert you that the overseers were not going to be away on the weekend as was planned, when it was planned that there was going to be a meeting in order to have a faith service. So not only do you have a spiritual, but you have a message contained within the spiritual. A gospel song is a modern attempt at a spiritual. It is possible to take a spiritual and add modern-day instruments to it and perhaps upbeat the tempo a bit, and it becomes a gospel song, but you can't do it the other way around. And of course, there is an enormous amount of music in the world that is spiritual in nature. But the American spiritual comes from a very distinct period in our history about which we are still trying to come to terms. So I hope that you understand what I was trying to say.
So a spiritual tells a very personal story.
A personal story, a very personal story.
And you've selected something for us to close the evening with.
Yes, an upbeat spiritual. Get on the train. We can imagine ourselves away from this enslavement. Thank you very much. Thank you. Wonderful.
Well, thank you to this wonderful audience.
Yes. Terrific. So attentive and wonderful.
Thank you to the Library Foundation for making these talks possible.
Yes, absolutely.
They should be supported.
Thank you. Thank you.
But most of all, Ms. Norman, what an honor. What an honor to spend this time with you and
thank you.
To talk to you. Thank you so very
much. You're so very kind.
Thank you
very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bless you. Thank you.
Your book.
Thank you. My book. It's this one. I've only got one. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bless you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.